Welcome to Turning the Table, the most progressive weekly podcast for today's food and beverage industry, featuring staff-centric operating solutions for restaurants in the hashtag New Hospitality Culture. Join Jim Taylor of Benchmark 60 and Adam Lamb as they turn the tables on the prevailing operating assumptions of running a restaurant in favor of innovative solutions to our industry's most persistent challenges. Thanks for joining us. And now, on to the show.
My name is Adam Lamb, and I'm a career coach for chefs and hospitality professionals, and I'd like to introduce you to my co-host, Jim Taylor of Benchmark 60.
What's up, Adam? Good to be back.
We missed you.
I missed you, yeah.
Like you ghosted us for the last episode. What did you do?
I was playing golf. I was I was on the California coast playing golf. I was lucky to have a chance to get away for a few days.
All right. Well, we'll get into that in a second, but this is episode 113, Seasonal Challenges for Restaurant Operators. We tried to have this episode last week, but it was interrupted by my co-host's trip, but that's okay. This little lunchbox live stream is broadcast every week on Thursday at 12 noon Eastern time on Turning the Table podcast page on LinkedIn, YouTube, and the Chef Life Coach page on Facebook. You can catch the podcast version, audio only, everywhere you get your podcasts, you know, in about 2 days when I can get the workflow going. We ask that you share the show with someone you care about who can find this information useful and leave a review. So, Jim, welcome back.
Thanks, man. It's good to be back. It's good to get back in the swing of things, you know, like, so look, good to have a few days to sort of decompress a bit on the beach.
Yeah, and for those who are not following the show, they should, because it is one of the quickest growing podcasts in the restaurant space. Just had a child not too long ago.
8 weeks, right? 2 months today.
I'm sorry, say that again.
It's 2 months today.
2 months today. And having a child ain't an easy thing for either parent. So I say bless your bride for telling you get the hell on out of here. And the opportunity came up and you decided to go to, well, you were gifted a trip down to California to play some golf. And where did you end up? I'm sorry, Pebble Beach? What?
Well, first of all, I should say it was Jen, my wife, it was her idea for me to go. We were back and forth, but she said, hey, you should go take this opportunity. So that's pretty cool. You're right. Bless my bride. Definitely. But yeah, we were at Pebble Beach for a few days.
And I've known, you know, I don't play golf. When I was in high school, I think I caddied for a couple years at the local community golf center. And I remember throwing a club my last day because I was like, God damn it, I'm never going to be in this place again.
Yeah.
And, I know that I have a slightly addictive nature. And if I ever took up golf, you know, I'd be like having the best clubs and everything. And so I decided like to opt out, create a barrier around that. And so what is it like to golf Pebble Beach?
Well, I mean, the whole someone who loves golf, but also being in the hospitality industry, I mean, it was just
right. An
unbelievable experience. I mean, you drop your golf clubs off at the check-in and you don't see them again for the weekend unless you're on the golf course. They just arrive when you are about to tee off or at the range when you need them or, you know, even just down to the service level in the hotel. You check in and somebody gives you a tour of the hotel on your way to your room and talks about all the history and, you know, you get up in the morning. They obviously charge a good rate to get there, but they don't penny pinch anything. It's all about the experience. You know, you can have whatever kind of nut milk latte you want in the morning, delivered to your room. You know, it's pretty impressive. So.
And what was your takeaway from that experience of like being like in the lap of luxury? I mean, granted, you know, you pay a good thing, but yeah. You get the value out. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, it's not a cheap place to go, but once you're there, there's no penny pinching on anything. It's everything is unbelievably good value, incredibly good quality. The service was just over the top everywhere. You know, 9 guys, I think we had 3 servers at dinner. You know, just the service was amazing everywhere we went. So yeah, at every single moment, whether it was, you know, like I said, getting your coffee in the morning or turn down service at night or what the lobby bar was like, the experience, I mean, all of it was just, you kind of feel like you never have to worry about anything, which as a customer in a hospitality space, really good feeling, right?
I mean, yeah.
So yeah, I walked away feeling incredibly lucky to have spent a few days there, and yeah, can't wait to go back. Hopefully one day.
And how did Jen feel when you got home? Was she like excited that you were coming back, or she was like, okay, I'm going to send you on another trip?
She was excited that I came home. I got home from the airport, had a quick shower, hopped back in the car and went and saw Jim Jefferies, a comedy show in Vancouver, which was, I mean, he's just off the charts too. So it was a great 4 or 5 days.
So that's interesting that you were talking about, you know, how the sense of hospitality pervaded everything. And I think that this is a great conversation to have because, especially going into some shoulder months, going into that, there's a misunderstanding about what service is and what hospitality is.
Yeah.
Can you speak to that? And like,
yeah, I mean, and my take on that is service is just, you know, can I get a water? Sure, here you go. Right. And hospitality was, you know, and a place like that is one of the it's one of the more high end places in, you know, probably in the country. So that's one thing. But even if it's not, you know, for someone to recognize you the day after you check in and use your name, or
right,
remember the coffee that you ordered the day before, or, you know, all of those little touches, it was just a very hospitable experience. And, you know, like you said, the seasonal change thing and shoulder season, I've, in my experience, both as a customer and as an employer, I think we've been guilty of seeing that change. You know, the service maybe diminishes a little bit because everyone's worried about cost and worried about revenue. And then it ramps back up for Christmas. And then it kind of, you know, there's a bit of a hesitation in January, February. So
what I'm hearing from you is that the things that made it special for you was not anything that actually cost money for an operator. It's actually the fact that being able to recall names or recall orders or to be able to greet somebody with some warmth that's actually authentic, right?
Yeah. You know, and you know, the funny, like you said about it not costing money, the two things that stood out the most the whole time that I was there, one was that every single time you were walking up towards an employee of any of the properties, they give you the right of way. So that I thought was very interesting. It was just very much about customer first. That and getting out of the shuttle or getting out of the Uber or whatever it was when we got there. It wasn't, can I take your bag? It was, I am taking your, like, you are not allowed to be, not allowed to touch any of that stuff while you're here with you, kind of thing. But that, it was a non-negotiable customer first. It's all about the experience. And that doesn't, like you said, it doesn't matter if you're charging $10 for an entree or $1,000 for an entree. You can still have that same approach.
Right. It's almost like assuming the position. Like, I am the authority in this space. I own it. I'm not trying to take anything away from you, but you don't have to worry about this now.
Yeah.
And I think I've worked for some pretty progressive hotel companies, and there's a lot of work that goes into training insofar as the way you stand, the way you look at somebody, at what point do you actually approach them? You know, there was the 10-2 rule. So at 10 feet, you look them in the eye, and 2 feet, you have to address them. And I thought that that was brilliant only because it actually got me out of an awkward space. So you might think that I'm pretty gregarious and like to talk, but really, you know, I'm all in my own head. So to be in a position where I have to, quote unquote, follow this procedure, quote unquote, in order to be, you know, a good employee, it actually forced me to kind of come out of my shell a little bit and actually look people in the eye and say, good morning. Hi, how are you? You know, yes, sir. No, sir. And I took all of that back into my space where, you know, I spent most of my time in the culinary side, but it was always like, we don't play around on the edges. Like it's yes, sir, no, sir. Thank you, ma'am, whatever. And not hey, baby, or any of that other bullshit. Right. So getting back to shoulder season, now what causes seasonal spikes in labor costs?
Yeah, we've been asked that question a few times.
Yeah, exactly. Like, especially because we all know it's coming. Like we are in the budget meeting. We know that these are the soft months. And I don't think shoulder months or soft months are the ones that are given the most attention to, but you know, we all know this is coming, yet somehow it all seems to like grab us by the pants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think that this was a conversation that you were involved in, but with a group that we've been working with, We actually were helping them proactively plan for Canadian Thanksgiving. And everybody knows that Canadian Thanksgiving is the quietest weekend of the year in restaurants, right? Everybody eats at home. So we did a bunch of proactive work with them on here's what the forecasting looks like. And here's help them work through what they were going to need to do in order to prevent the spike in percentage on labor costs in that week. And out of 8 locations, one of them actually accomplished it. The rest of them, they still went, knew what it was telling us. We knew what happened last year. We knew what happened in 2019. Mm-hmm. Forget 2020. And they still didn't respond quick enough, to the tune of almost $8,000 at each location. Right. So the company lost, $35,000-$40,000 in 1 week. Mm-hmm. And I guess the next one coming is January, right? And just what happens from the Christmas business model to the January business model, at least in the colder parts of the country and Canada, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it has to do also with the fact that we've been through, 3 years of complete uncertainty. What we knew before COVID now no longer holds. Mm. So it's almost like, will people come out? Is there going to be another Omicron rise? I mean, I look at all the statistics and, there's starting to be a rise in Europe, which is about 3 weeks in front of us. And so are operators actually looking at that to try to consider how best to staff their restaurants in order to maximize their opportunity for flow through?
So prior to pandemic related stuff, how did you used to prepare your kitchens for that thing, like a seasonal change, whether it was cost or dropping right. revenue or, because I was all front house. Mm-hmm.
And we all know that the biggest cost is in the back of the house. So put it all on me, baby.
Yeah, right.
So, I spent 25 years in South Florida, Fort Lauderdale specifically, and we got really, really good at being able to gauge seasonal spikes and slowdowns. And there's a couple different things that go into that. I mean, when you think that, the local population is probably slowing down, all the people from Quebec come down and start flooding. So it's like a weird mix. So typically what would happen is September, the first week of September always sucks because everybody's going back to school. And then it starts slowly, incrementally coming up. And then Christmas and New Year's is hell week. Like everybody's, holding on.
Yeah.
And then right after that, there's a big pull down. So generally speaking, what would happen is we would staff up right around September, those first 3 weeks, and start pulling in people, getting them trained so that everybody's in their position and we're rock solid. Yeah. And then as it came down on the other side, which would have been April, May, the staff is basically winnowed out and there's basically nothing but, chefs and kitchen managers left in the kitchen, right? Write out the summer. And that's why most of the service staff go from Florida to Block Island or somewhere else in Maryland easily and go back and forth. But I don't know too many people that can actually consistently do that just because it's such a tear on the body, man. So I'm a data freak. I just love diving into the data. And the more I learned, the more it became clear to me that if I wasn't prepared before these seasonal spikes, that I'd be like left out in the cold because you cannot make up that space from a revenue standpoint quick enough.
Right.
Or from a cost standpoint, and I'll be the first one to say that there was a time when I pencil whipped the cases shrimp in the freezer. I'm sorry, I did it. I did it. But you're coming down to the end of that 30 days, and for most of us, our calendar year fiscally ends December 31st. So if you make a mistake in October, there is no way you're going to make it up in December. No way. Just can't happen. So then all of a sudden you start looking for creative ways into hotels. Sorry. I won't speak to the employer, but yeah, he knows.
He already knows about it. You confessed.
I did. I had to go up to finance and go, I don't know what to do. I was very young in my career and it literally started out as one box of shrimp in the freezer. Mm-hmm. And in 3 months, it was a case because I could not make up the gap between what was there and what the revenue dictated. So it was like a slippery slope. And I wish somebody had told me that I was being that stupid at the time. But
and most of the other chefs and bar managers who've done the same thing. I mean,
is there a case of vodka on the floor? I don't know. Could be.
Well, and it doesn't even have to be a case of vodka. Is that bottle half full or three quarters?
Right. And before the technology caught up for it, caught up to it, it was like, is it one fifth, one quarter? And now you've got these systems where you put the bottle on and it's calculating exactly what it is, which is fantastic from a control standpoint, yet still doesn't answer the fundamental question about, like, how do we get into these conundrums? Like, how the productivity metric could actually save us from those types of conundrums, like having to make those type of decisions in the moment. Because I get that if you can maximize your flow through, you're in the catbird seat. However, as it starts to trend off, like maybe more quickly than you're actually able to calculate, right? Because that's what happens. Like everything happens like that, and you're like, oh shit, I gotta cut the staff tomorrow.
Yeah,
and then I'm stuck.
Part of it's about making up for lost revenue or preventing seasonal spike, but part of it's about having a better understanding if the level of productivity remains the same through every month of the year, but customers behave differently, then our labor cost is going to change no matter what.
Wait a second, man. That's like juicy. So you're saying it's basically the same overall, but depending on whether or not your customer feels like it's been a tight fiscal quarter and he doesn't necessarily want to buy the dessert, right? The customer spend drives everything. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah. So I usually, you know, one of the examples that I get into a lot, and you and I have talked about this before, but consider the difference between in the restaurant business between December and January. Mm-hmm. And let's say this is not in Florida. This is in a market where things slow down dramatically in January, right? The differences between December and January are significant.
I can tell you the market that I'm in right now, which is Asheville, North Carolina. There's that fourth season with all the leaves turning, but which is like that pop in October. But right after that, it drops way down, man, down.
Yeah.
And everybody's just holding on for dear life.
We find there's low-hanging fruit quite often is if you can maintain the same level of productivity in business consistently, then the low months – you know, the months where the revenue is going to dip, you're going to see a spike in labor costs. And that's normal because it's based on less customers and less spend per customer. But it also means that in the months where you have more customers and more spend per customer, your labor cost is actually going to come down. And that's not a bad thing. It doesn't mean you're short staffed. So, you know, quite often what we're trying to find ways to do is help clients and restaurant operators and all of this understand that, let's say a 25% total labor cost in December is actually too high, and a 30% labor cost in January might be too low, which probably sounds crazy. It maybe should be 22 and 31. But if you look at that over the course of the whole year, it's going to even out to 27 or whatever it is that you wanted to get it to. Right? So, you know, that looking at it in terms of how productive the business is really helps to remove stress around why is my cost spiking? To make sure we capture opportunity in months where there's opportunity available.
Totally get it. And this leads me to my next question, which is, traditionally speaking, using a labor cost metric, are we actually shooting ourselves in the foot with the way our budgets are established? 100%. I mean, there is a lot of work that goes into a yearly budget.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be called into one of those meetings and having to defend yourself or advocate for higher prices. I mean, I've been in both of those situations where I've had to like bring in every possible document that I can counter. Like, okay, so these are the trends. This is what's going on. And I'm telling you that sometime between this time and this time, the market reports will tell you straight up what prices are going to be. But yet a lot of times, you know, nobody wants to hear that.
No, they just want to look at the percentage or the dollar amount that came out of the bank.
Right. Yeah, because in the end of the day, it is just dollars in, dollars out, right?
100% it is. But if the budget's written on percentage, and this is I shouldn't use the term argument, but this is a good discussion and debate that we get into. If the budget is written on percentage, and you expect that percentage to remain flat all year, we can tell you from without even looking at a P&L, without even knowing what color the walls are in a certain restaurant, that if the percentage is the same in December as it is in January, there's a good chance the business left money on the table in December and overworked the team in January.
Right. And that's every operator's nightmare, right? To have to cut and cut and cut, send people home in a month where, you know, most of them are actually looking towards some type of holiday, right, that they need to support their family. And then right after that, get so jammed up that they, you know, can't spend any time with them because of short-term thinking. So I'm curious to know, but like, why would anyone, any operator out there, decide to even take a look at this particular process when, as far as they know, it's as good as it's going to get?
Well, I mean, I could answer that in lots of different ways, but
I know it's a loaded question, man, but I think you're used to that from me, right?
Yeah. So, okay. So why should I look at something differently? Because prices are different. Menus are different. Wage structure is different. Employee benefits are different. Supply chain is different. Everything is, the entire industry has changed.
Yep.
So if the strategy doesn't change along with it, you know, it's likely not going to keep up. And, you know, that's why we talk about this all the time. You know, the way that we're trying to approach this is it's the end of we've always done it this way.
Right.
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 If all of those things, I mean, just consider the wage structure in restaurants and menu pricing in restaurants are so dramatically different based on labor shortages and inflation right now. If we haven't adjusted the way we look at targets and budgets in correlation, we're behind the eight ball already.
I can only imagine what operators in, say, Belgium or Germany or the UK are looking at right now, because with, you know, 300-500% spikes in their energy costs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard from a couple of our partners that folks are like, it's cheaper for me to close the doors, man. Everyone knows in Florida that there's going to be a hurricane at some point.
Yeah.
Right. Why not build in some infrastructure, some resiliency in the budget to be able to support that? What they say is one in a hundred or one in a thousand. Like, that's the excuse. It's once in a decade. Like, I don't care when it is. Like, we all know it's going to happen. And if anybody's listening to this in Florida, you know, waters are rising and Miami's already starting to pump out streets. So if you're not planning for that, how are you going to manage anything in the future? Because it's always going to be disaster after disaster after disaster. And so if you're in an area that's troublesome, aren't you doing your due diligence by saying, like, should I have my business here? Should I move it? Kind of ties into the same thing about having a business that's flexible, that's ready to meet any particular challenge, whether it's not shut down or whatever. I think we got to take the blinders off. I think we got to take the blinders off and say there will be other things that are going to be coming. The pandemic is not over. I don't care what anybody else says. And if we're not planning for this, there's no way to keep staff. And as we all know, Jim Taylor, retention is the new cool.
Retention is the new cool. Well, and you know, just one last comment on that. The way that all of these variables have changed in the industry, you know, back when you were a sous chef and when I was, you know, managing a floor.
Oh, boy.
If someone said, hey, your labor cost percentage is high, based on the way that wages and menu prices were, you probably needed to like send one person home an hour and a half early and hit your target on the whole shift with two people less, right? And it just, the same approach of cut hard, work harder, go in on your day off, do your admin from home, all of that type of stuff, it just doesn't work anymore, right? Because the industry is short-staffed as it is, and now we're trying to find ways in shoulder season to hit targets by just working harder. And it's just, you know, it's going to compound and make things worse.
So working harder is not the answer.
We say this all the time. There's a difference between hard work and having to work too hard.
Yeah, but I spent my entire career, you know, with that idea of like, if I just work a little harder, if I just like, you know, if I just focus in just a little bit harder, everything's going to be work out.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Why aren't you in a kitchen anymore?
I am, right in back of me.
Well, it's you know,
there comes a certain point in every chef's life, if I can just say this out loud, that we have to consider our own mortality and our own physicality. I've had two back surgeries, a neck surgery. I know what it's like to like spin and jump on a saute station and slam it all day long, or expedite, you know, 500 over early bird. And yet I understand that there are some physical limitations that go against the idea that I am still a young man. My opportunity now is to leverage everything that I've experienced and learned to support others in the pursuit of the hashtag new hospitality structure, because I know that a lot of us came into the industry with the same ideas and the same hopes and didn't ask for what we want because, you know, there was just no asking, man. Nobody gave a shit. Now things have opened up a little bit and I celebrate that, and I want to support the next generation of, you know, leaders, tourists, supervisors, chefs. I celebrate that. So I'm not going to sit on the sidelines and just expect someone else to do that. I mean, I want to throw my hat in the ring, or my toque in the ring, as it were. So why do you ask? Why am I not in the kitchen?
Well, because, you know, I've said this lots before too, that there's a difference between hard work and having to work too hard. Right. And that's where our industry is at right now. The restaurant industry never will be easy work. It's grind. It is, right? It's long hours. It's shift work. It's split shifts. It's, you know, split days off. It's work on holidays. Right. That stuff's never going to change because our industry is in service of other people. So it's going to be there for people. But having to work so hard that you're burnt out, that you're exhausted, that you're having mental health challenges, that, you know, that stuff comes to the forefront more actually in our experience with the restaurant groups that we've worked with. The overworking and the workload management stuff comes into effect and into account more in downturn season than it does in busy times. Mm.
Right. I've talked to so many chefs lately, just lately, and they're all kind of singing the same song about like this. There's a deep sadness that they're completely undervalued by their employers, by the customers, and they don't know what to do, because if it was up to them, they would still hang in there, because they, like, it takes a very, very special person to commit themselves to a life of service, as you said, whether it's in the front of the house or the back of the house. You know, I get certain positions, there's a little bit of power. You know, behind the bar, you got all the power. To break the chain of an expectation that someone should actually appreciate how much work you put in, when they will never ever understand that, is kind of like my job one, because, and only speaking for myself, getting in the industry, I was like kind of locked into this immediate feedback loop of instant gratifications, put up a great plate. Someone comes back and says, hey, that's really great. Thank you very much. And all of a sudden I feel good. Mm-hmm. Which belied the fact that really, as a mature professional, there is this whole idea about laying gratification and building things for the future. And so in this stage, as an elder in the community, as I claim, I think it's my responsibility to be able to build those structures in, because again, like you said, the people that are coming into the industry now are asking, certainly they're not asking, some are demanding a certain way of being, a certain expectation of their job. And I was just looking at LinkedIn, Chef added a new module to their free educational platform about employee retention. And one of the things was like being incredibly realistic about communicating what the possibilities are. Right. And I thought that was brilliant, because as Chef Dodge told us before in another episode, you know, there's a disconnect behind people coming in the industry and what they think will happen and what we know the reality to be. But it's not to say that our job is to like slam them down and say your reality is nothing. Our job is to kind of meet them in the middle and say, okay, so what is possible? And so I'm working to make sure that everyone understands that this is an honorable, profitable profession that's worthy of their time and effort. And if they're called to be in this industry, then come on in. I don't want anybody scared, like, oh my God, like I read all the papers and saw that. We together can make it a better place. And that's why I'm partnered with you.
Well, and vice versa. And you know what? It's the role of the leaders in our industry to protect the people in the industry, to find new ways to do things, to keep up with what change is happening, you know, to look at other industries in terms of how they have weathered these types of storms before, yep. you know, all those types of things. I mean, even Google right now, talking about this productivity thing we were looking at earlier, the CEO of Google announced about a month ago, a company-wide simplicity sprint is what they're calling it. Company as an organization worldwide to look at ways to become more productive because they're aware of the fact that so many variables are changing that they can't keep up with just things like pricing or layoff right. or put a hiring freeze in. They have to find ways to be more productive. And the same applies for our industry right now.
Now, if we're not willing to look at other industries to see what works for them, like I know that you like to say that this productivity thing came from manufacturing, but I was like playing around with this in 2006, 2007. It was already out there. It wasn't effectively applied. Like I laughed so much when we first got together. I'm like, wait a second. It's like I was off by one decimal. Yeah. But it just proves that solution existed and that we're all kind of tapped into it. So I think it behooves all of us as operators. And especially because we're in a relationship with our customers, we're in a relationship with our fellow managers, we're in a relationship with our associates. And I think that's where it kind of comes back to, you know, this whole idea about hospitality is all about relationship. And if we fucking forget that, man, then what the hell are we doing here?
Yeah. And the same, it goes for customers and staff, right? Yeah. The term we use all the time is you got to protect your people.
I have a really great question for the next episode, but I'm going to hold off on it right now. Because it would launch us into another thing because there was someone who DM'd me on a social media platform about a situation with the guest. And his question was like, how do I, as a small business owner, protect my staff and also, you know, honor my guests mm-hmm. when my guests might not necessarily be acting appropriately, but neither did we. So it was a really great conversation, especially on the tail end of this whole thing with James Corden, you know, going into a restaurant and like being an asshole and then like being banned from like the cancel culture. Like, yeah, probably some people should be canceled, but you know, without due process, I'm sorry. I just don't go for that shit. And it prevents people from actually owning their own bad behavior and perhaps apologizing and trying to make amends. So I am all down for trying to bring in harmony in these particular situations, but I will save that for our next episode. Because I'm sure you got a lot to say with it, because I'm sure you've had plenty of... I'm sure you've had plenty of, you know... Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, for another day.
Well, for next week, for sure. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Adam.
You bet.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Turning the Table with me, Adam Lamb, and Jim Taylor. This episode was sponsored by Benchmark 60. We're on a mission to change the food and beverage industry by focusing on staff mental health and well-being by forecasting and actively managing workload productivity. Over 200 restaurants and food and beverage operations have discovered for themselves how to increase staff retention and become a preferred employer in their market by using our proprietary system. If you'd like to have an operational culture that everybody wants to work for, then check out Benchmark 60 on the web at www.benchmark60.com. Thanks for taking the time to be with us and the courage to try new things for the restaurant profession's oldest problems. Turning the Table is a production of Realignment Media.